Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, John Schwab here from Curtain Call, and welcome to episode 93 of the Curtain Call Theater Podcast, the podcast that brings you backstage as close as you possibly can be, often while the shows are actually happening, to meet the people that make that theater happen. You can find all our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other fine podcast streaming services. So, you know, go back there and find them and fill your boots. And if you have a spare 30 seconds, please rate and review the podcast to help us be more discoverable to listeners who haven't heard about us yet. But now for this week's podcast. I'm actually away on holiday this week, recording this in Florida. I do apologize. So Curtain Call's Theo Bosanquet has jumped in for me and chatted with George Richmond Scott, the director of Blood Wedding, which is the inaugural production at the Omnibus Theater in their autumn season. Theo and George talked about his career as a vocal coach, how that role has helped him develop as a director, his time at the Sheffield Crucible, assisting on Everybody's Talking About Jamie, why he chose Blood Wedding as his next project, and why he set it in London in this reimagining of a classic piece. Have a listen.
Hello, I'm at the Clapham Omnibus Theatre, sitting in one of the dressing rooms as the rain, the very rare rain this time, pitter-patters on our glass roof. And I'm sitting here with George Richmond Scott, who's the director of the inaugural production in the Omnibus's autumn season, which is Blood Wedding. George, hello.
Hi there.
Thank you very much for talking to Curtain Call. You've had a very interesting career to date, which has included, I think, 15 years of work as a voice coach. So we'll get onto that in a minute, because I think there's lots of interesting sort of strands that we can that we can get into. But firstly, tell us why you wanted to direct Blood Wedding, first of all.
Well, I've always loved the play since I was about 16. And it was on the A-level syllabus at that time. And Lorca still is, I think, but not that play. And so we studied it, and I was really captivated by just the weirdness of it, I think. It's such a bizarre, surreal, different world that he writes about and conjures up to anything that I had an experience of. So I felt really just excited and seduced by the world of it, and also by the language of it, although obviously I was reading it in translation, and translations vary massively, but I just remember loving the way the characters express themselves in this really intense, poetical, metaphorical language that kind of reflected the natural world and the environment that they existed in.
The production is billed as being told through a female lens. Tell us what that means a little bit.
Yeah, I suppose it would be more accurate to say that it's skewed to the viewpoint of the female characters, and specifically to that of the mother, who she kind of makes a big splash in the original at the beginning, and then she just doesn't disappear, but she sort of bookends it, I suppose, and she then has a massive kind of very intense scene at the end when the bride comes back. And I was just interested to see how we could have her woven more through the, more consistently through the story. And there's obviously a whole section where she's not there. And I was reading it and thinking about this, and I'm particularly interested in her as a character and what she holds in herself and why she behaves the way she does. And I had the idea of the actor who's playing that part doubling up with, in Lorca's original, the beggar woman, in our version, the homeless woman, but basically she's a personification of death. So the mother and death are the same actor, and in one sense are the same character, or two sides of a character. One side is the kind of loving, nurturing, protective, and the other is the destructive, I'm going to end you.
That's an interesting tension, I guess, that sits Certainly sounds like it sits at the heart of the production. And the play. You've also said it in London as well, haven't you?
Tell
us about that decision.
Well, when I spoke to Marie, when I first met her, the artistic director of this theatre, the Omnibus, we talked about maybe Lorca, and they're really keen on things being twisted and reimagined for this venue. I think partly because the venue itself used to be something else and has been reimagined. It was the old town library of Clapham, and now it's a theatre and an art space. So she talked about not just doing somebody else's translation of it, but actually reimagining it, which provoked me to kind of think about how I might do that. And because I'm not Spanish and I haven't lived in Spain, it felt like a sensible step to bring the story to London, which is where I was born, and I've got a very strong sense of what it is to live in this city and to be from here. So that felt like a kind of sensible thing to do. And also, in a way, I suppose, because the story's so strange, and I think sometimes it doesn't always land very easily with the British audience, it felt like it might help people to connect to the story and as a way into the story, to bring it to here, and also to bring it to now, and not to be telling it, you know, this 1930s characters, but people who are living in the here and now. But then I started to think, am I going to pull it so far away from what it has been that it's going to destroy it or spoil it? So it seems to me then, again, right at the beginning, that I wanted the characters to stay Spanish or have Spanish heritage. And so I just had the idea of it being kind of based around a Spanish restaurant in London, and the mother and the son run the restaurant, all the mother's dead husband sort of set it up when they first moved over here, and the other characters are sort of radiating around them as kind of people they're connected to or related to who live in the city or who go backwards and forwards between here and Spain.
Yeah. We were talking actually before we started recording about the Young Vic production of Yerma, which is one of the other plays, I guess, and it's loosely a trilogy, isn't it, with Bernardo Alba and Yerma.
I think maybe in terms of sort of some themes and so on, it is. Not necessarily in terms of story, but no. They're certainly his three really famous, like classic plays, aren't they?
The ones we see most often, and of course. Yerma particularly was an incredibly modern updating of that story, and it was a good example of something we've seen a lot recently, which is classics being very vigorously brought up to date without too much nervousness about completely rewriting the text.
Yeah.
Do you think it matters? Do you think sort of textual loyalty, if for want of a better word, is important, or do you think it's more important to capture the spirit of the emotions of the characters, of the themes, and sort of communicate that to a modern audience?
I don't know if any of that's important if you're going to completely reimagine something. I think it's you're making a new piece of art, dare I say it. I think it's absolutely essential to acknowledge where it's come from and to kind of respect the person who originally wrote the first story. And when people don't do that, that's really offensive. To me, it's exciting to reimagine something and to make something new out of something else. And I think it's better in a way if it's a really big, bold change. And if it sort of goes halfway, then I think it's sort of more noticeable that that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
Whereas something like Simon Stone's Yerma, which was such a beautiful, incredible piece of work, it was like a different play. It was clearly inspired by the original, and the central character kind of felt fairly intact, but it felt like a whole different piece of art to me, and so I was interested and excited to see connect it back to where it come from, but I could appreciate it as a completely separate thing in its own right, and then that worked well for me subjectively as an audience member, and it made me feel, I suppose it gave me confidence to be fairly bold myself. Although I would say with our story, I've tried to preserve, is not the right word at all, but I've tried to keep the integrity of the poetry in the way the characters talk and express their desires and their intentions, but just reimagine it for people who are living in an urban environment right now, rather than a rural Spanish one in the 1930s. So we haven't kind of removed the poetry in order to make it contemporary. In fact, I've gone to great lengths not to do that.
For what it's worth, I don't agree with the school of thought that is, if the play is reimagined to a certain degree, then it no longer, then it sort of ceases to be the play. I think the key thing is communication and eliciting emotion and connection, and that surely has to take precedence over what can be a rather sort of dry fealty to the original. Mm. And it feels like the new generation of theatre makers, yourself included, have just really kind of taken the classics by the throat, and as a result endeared a whole generation of theatre goers to them in a way that you know, maybe they were previously seen as a bit of a sort of something you had to see rather than something you wanted to see. And now, for me anyway, it's just great that we've got this flourishing of productions that really are bringing them back up to date.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. Let's talk about your career to date, because you started, I think, as a voice coach.
I did, yeah.
Tell us how that sort of came about.
I'm really honest, I started as an actor a long time ago and did that for about 5 years.
Right.
And then realised that I couldn't stand auditioning and hadn't got as far as I wanted to, so I retrained when I was young, quite young, as a voice coach. You tend to be a bit older to do that job. That just seemed to slot into place really easily. It seemed to fit with my personality and my life, and I got work while I was still training, and so it felt like the right thing.
Yeah.
Before it had been an appalling struggle knocking at doors which were very firmly closed, and suddenly the voice doors all opened up. So
What does a voice coach do exactly?
Speak up! Speak clearer.
Yeah?
£50, please. No, 100 now. A voice coach is there to support the actors and the story and the director in terms of things being as clear as they possibly can be, as connected as they possibly can be, in terms of the voice and the body and the voice into the psychology, I suppose. So they had to be really careful not to tread on directors' toes, and then also just technically and practically, the other side of things, like, you know, can we hear you in the worst seat in the house when you're being really quiet and all of that stuff, and if not, how can we adjust things without you sounding fake so that you're giving everybody their money's worth. So there's a sort of really practical, straightforward side to the job, and then there's a sort of much more creative, connected into the acting side of the job, which is, and both are fun, actually, both are fun, but the latter's where my heart lay and still lies, and that's then a really delicate dance around the work the director and the other creators are doing, because you have to, I think with every job you do as a in any of these roles, like a voice coach or perhaps a movement director, where you're kind of coming in and working alongside somebody who's perhaps steering the project, you've just got to be really sensible and sensitive, and also, in a way, create your space for your work each time afresh and find the room for it, and also convince people of the need for it and the worth for it. And you might have been brought in to kind of solve one particular kind of actor's lack of training or whatever, but if you're canny, you can end up doing really interesting, useful work with the whole company. You just have to kind of
And it must, I would imagine it really helps your work as a director to have come from that background, or does it not?
I hope it does.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm certainly still aware of those things, although I have to be honest, the couple of times that I've had a voice coach as a director more recently, I've really loved it. And I've really enjoyed being able to switch off that part of my brain up to a certain point and just focus in on the other stuff, which is relatively new to me, and let somebody else be that person in the room. And when I've worked with good voice coaches, which I'm lucky to have done, it's such a pleasure. And also, I hope this will always continue. I value that role because I know what it is and I know what it feels like to do it. And I hope I've given them space and agency and, you know, full positive permission to do what they need to do and collaborate properly, you know, not just kind of come in and give a few notes.
Do you think actors today need more help vocally than in the past? It's a classic thing that you always read in... you know, from certain commentators who say that not enough emphasis is put on, projection to be basic about it. But
if actors have a training from a drama school, which they don't always necessarily do, and some brilliant actors don't have one, but if they do, they tend to do a massive amount of voice. It's like quite a big part of the process of being trained. So it's not that the work isn't happening, and it's not that the work isn't good, because I know it is, because not just because I've done it, but because I've worked alongside brilliant voice teachers and voice coaches. So I think tastes change. I think this is maybe not a controversial thing to say, but an obvious thing to say, but I think very often the people who make those criticisms tend to be actors and other people in the industry who have got to a certain age where perhaps your hearing isn't as good as it used to be, and so you're not actually hearing things in the way that you once heard them, and you're then kind of making the assumption that the fault lies in the young actor rather than in your own ears. So I think there is that, and that sounds a bit silly, but I do think that's a thing. If you look at where the comments like that come from, they're nearly always from people who are quite old, or often are. I don't want to start talking about kind of mobile phones and all of that and people not communicating verbally anymore, because we all know that that's the way things are now, and that's not going to change probably anytime soon, or at least it certainly is the way things are. So we just got to roll with that and work with it. And it doesn't mean that people can't also be on voice and vocally connected. So I think we can do both. But maybe there's more of a call for the work now than there used to be, because we talk to each other a bit less. But I don't know. It's too easy to kind of say all of that, really. And I know loads of young actors who've got brilliant voices. So, yeah.
Let's talk about your work in Sheffield, which... Mm. So you obviously worked as a voice coach decided to move more into directing. And
yeah, I'd done bits and pieces on the side, been up to the Edinburgh Festival and directed projects in drama schools. That started out as a kind of, I'm there as the voice teacher and they want to make sure that I'm being used as fully as possible with my hours I'm being paid for. So why don't you just do that project over there and we won't get someone else in for it? And I'm like, absolutely great. Fantastic. And then I got to a point where I just sort of sat back and took stock and realised that what was making me most happy was the directing. Not that I didn't love the voice work too, but that was what was really making me feel passionate about going to work. So I had a conversation about it with somebody else I was actually teaching alongside, who had just decided to go to Birkbeck College to do the theatre directing MFA. And she's not as old as I am, but she was mature and had a career as an actor and whatnot. And she just decided to do it anyway and take the risk and jump in. So that inspired me to do the same. And I applied for the course. And so the second year of the course is in a theatre, which is the most kind of amazing, appealing thing about the course, is you're not in a... That was the other thing, is I didn't want to go to a drama school for a year trying to be a director, and half of them I've talked in as a voice coach, and it would be really uncomfortable. And, but Birkbeck's different, because you're at Birkbeck College, or you're in a theatre training to do it, which was... It just felt like exactly the right thing to do. And I was just very lucky that I managed to get to go to the theatre I wanted to go to most, which was The Crucible in Sheffield. at first because Daniel Evans was running it and I admire him and his work, and it just felt like a very exciting, eclectic place to go and learn. And then I found out that he was going, but that Robert Hastie was taking over, and I had, by pure good chance, assisted him as a first-year placement on my training. And so I was able to contact him and say, would you be interested in having a placement, even though it's your first year and you probably want a bit of space? And I think because we'd got an okay, that he said yes. And I got to go up to the Crucible, and I completely fell in love with Sheffield. It's the most amazing city. I cannot recommend it enough. If you haven't been, you should definitely go. And the Crucible is also, it's the biggest theatre complex outside of London, I believe, the three theatres together, and that Rob's taking over, there was this incredible new energy and kind of buzz in the air as well, so it just felt like an entirely thrilling experience to be up there. And I could go on about this probably for the next 2 hours if you let me.
Well, the probably the production that made, I guess, the biggest splash during your time there, which you worked on, was Everybody's Talking About Jamie. Tell us about, you know, your involvement in that project and how it came to being, and then watching it become this big West End show that it has.
Well, it was a complete and glorious surprise, because I started off the placement knowing what the three big shows were that I was going to assist on as part of my training. And it was Lady Chatterley's Lover, directed by Philip Bream, and that I was excited about that because I like the idea of doing a classic adaptation, and I knew his work and he's brilliant. And then it was Julius Caesar assisting Robert Hastie, and that was also really exciting, and I couldn't wait to work with him again on a really big stage. And then there was this new musical called Everybody's Talking About Jamie, which I knew nothing about at all. Didn't know Jonathan's work, because a lot of it he's done in New York. And I didn't know the story, and so I just thought, well, that'll be fun, you know, and it'll be a bit of a laugh, and it'll come and it'll go, and, you know, I can say I've worked in a musical. But I realised really, really quickly when I went into the rehearsal room that this was going to be something quite special. And just the scale of it as well, the size of it was a big company of actors and a really big creative team, which at first was a little bit alarming. Like, how am I going to fit in and do anything of use here with all of these people who are already kind of set up? But they were so warm and welcoming, and that didn't turn out to be an issue at all. And in fact, there was a huge amount of work to do because it's such a musical, it's such a big beast, a big musical. And it just had an amazing kind of a buzz around it from the very beginning, actually. And it was taken into the hearts of the audience in Sheffield really, really quickly. We only played for 2.5 weeks when we were at the Crucible at the beginning of last year, but it packed out, and we had to they close some of the theatre off when they're doing new works. They shrink it from 900 to 600 seats, and they had to expand it right back out to 900, and it still was completely full. And we got every kind of person coming in to watch it, all ages, and the standing ovations at the end of it. And I was also, because I was very still kind of watching the story like a new thing each time, I was, you know, completely moved by it, and it tends to make people laugh a lot, and then it tends to move people a great deal in the second half, and people often kind of dissolve into tears, and then there's this amazing kind of positive surge of, yes, it's all right to be who you are in life at the end, and everybody leaps to their feet. And it really is, it's a very physical experience to watch the show, and I was still watching it in that way all the way through Sheffield. And so I got kind of completely caught up in the this beautiful, glittery, very, very positive story and message. So it was amazing. I just remember saying at the end of the Sheffield run, if this does ever go anywhere else, Jonathan, I'd love to work on it. And I sort of thought, well, you know, I'm still training, and the chances are that somebody else will be brought in, but that's fine. You know, fingers crossed. And then it happened, and I got to do it. So I felt very, very lucky, and very proud as well to be part of it.
What an incredible project to be involved in. I struggle, it's almost hard to believe that you got to work on something like that as part of a training scheme, essentially, or as part of a course.
Yeah.
This was I mean, you literally cannot think of a better
no.
training ground than that.
I can't, no.
And what a great sort of example of the power of vocational training as well, that actually, you know, for anyone working in theatre, being in the theatre is, of course, the best place to do that, being in rehearsal rooms, being around people doing it. Not to at all sort of suggest that the work of drama schools is not effective.
No, some of those courses are amazing.
But that element is also key.
Yeah, and to understand every, not that I do know, I know every facet inside out, but to be able to work in every department of a theatre as well, and to kind of be in an open plan office with the marketing department and with the accounts department and with, you know, everybody who, and the education department, everybody who's involved in putting the show on, and every kind of facet of it. You accelerate your learning incredibly, and it just makes you kind of, I suppose voice coaching is in no way a narrow thing, but I suppose it's got a kind of focused viewpoint to it, if you like, whereas directing feels to me like, if you're going to do a good job, you've got to try and have a panoramic view of a whole production and story and every kind of bit of it, whilst still being able to kind of zero in on detail when you need to. And so the training back and at the Crucible, and it still feels like it's happening now, I'm still learning a huge amount on Jamie, feels like it's just grabbed hold of my brain and is pulling the sides of it wider so that I can kind of see a bigger picture than I used to be able to see. And there's no exaggeration to say that the training has changed my brain and the way that I look at not just theatre but life.
Fantastic. So what's the plan now? What does the future look like? You know, I know that's always a difficult question to anybody working in theatre because, of course, it's very hard to predict. But in a sort of ideal world, what you know, where do you go from here? I guess obviously Blood Wedding immediately, but then.
Yeah, Blood Wedding starts on Monday, rehearsals, so that's occupying most of my conscious mind at the moment. And I've got a couple of ideas, two or three plays I'd love to direct after that. I won't talk about them now because they're kind of, you know, little kernels that need to be watered and planted somewhere, actually. So I've got some kind of immediate desires in terms of what I'd like to do next, and I'm going to hopefully stay with Jamie for a while as well and keep working on that, which is exciting. In the next year they're going to be making a film as well, so that will be kind of fueling the excitement around the theatre productions,
and you'll be involved in
The Outsiders. S.E. Hinton's generation defining novel is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.